Chapter 10. The Manaus Museum of Natural History was very quiet this weekday morning. The boy who swept the floors was outside, weeding the flower beds. The porter dozed in his cubicle, and there were no visitors. But in his lab behind the office, Professor Glastonbury was worrying about the giant sloth. He often worried about the sloth. For the past year he had been putting the skeleton of the great beast together, and it was going to make the most impressive exhibit. At least it should have done. For the truth was, the skeleton was not complete. It was nearly complete, but not quite. One rib was missing. The third rib on the left-hand side. Professor Glastonbury had made a false rib out of the plaster of Paris, and now he fitted it carefully into the breastbone, and it looked fine. At least it did if he didn't know. The trouble was that the professor did know. He stood looking at his handiwork. The sloth on its metal stand seemed to fill the whole room. He took the rib out. He put it in again. He sighed. A false rib was cheating, but a missing rib was untidy. At that moment he heard the creaking of the revolving doors and, peering out, realised that two people had come into the museum whom he recognised. The tall, thin woman who had been interested in Bernard Taverner's collection, and the schoolgirl who had been with her, a girl with a lot of dark hair and intelligent eyes. He came out of his office and said, "Good morning." The tall woman smiled and at once looked less alarming. "This is Maya," she said. "She has come to make some drawings of birds' wings. May I leave her here to work on her own? I'll fetch her at 3 o'clock. I don't think she'll be any trouble."
"I'm sure she won't," said the professor.
He was still holding the false rib and looked distracted.
"What a large rib," said Miss Minton.
"Yes."
He took a deep breath and poured out the problem of the missing bone.
"No one could know it was not the real one," he said.
Miss Minton looked severe.
"You would know," she said.
The professor sighed.
"Oh, that's what Taverner used to say."
"May we see it? The sloth?" asked Maya.
"Certainly."
He led them through his office and into the lab. "It's not upside down," said Maya. "I thought sloths always hung from trees."
"Not the giant sloths. They'd have splintered any tree they tried to hang from. This one would have weighed about 3 tons when it was alive, but they've been extinct for thousands of years."
Once again the professor put the rib in, and once again he took it out.
"What do you think?"
"I think you should go and find the missing bone," said Miss Minton.
The professor stared at her. Was she serious? Surely not.
"I'm afraid that's impossible," he said. "The original skeleton came from a cave near the Zante River, miles away to the north, and I'm too old for expeditions."
"Nonsense," said Miss Minton. "Anyone who can walk can go on expeditions."
Then she took her leave, and Maya said good morning to the stuffed Pekingese before she settled down at a table near the Birds of Flight exhibit and began to draw. It was good to be in the museum again, and away from the carters. Not just the Pekingese, but the Amazonian river slug, the lumpy manatee, the shrunken head, all seemed like old friends, and of course, the Taverner collection, which she was now saw with new eyes. And as she drew, Maya tried to puzzle out the problem of her governess. Maya had told Miss Minton that Clovis was safe with the Indian boy. Miss Minton had nodded, but she asked no more questions. It was strange how little she asked Maya about her comings and goings, when she pounced on every strand of unbrushed hair or a fingernail not scrubbed to cleanliness. Then when Maya said she needed to go and work in the museum to finish her project on Birds of the Rainforest, Minty had done no more than raise an eyebrow and had gone about arranging it. She had even persuaded Mrs. Carter to let them go down on the rubber boat so as to give them more time in Manaus. And why did Finn want to know Miss Minton's Christian name? But she wasn't in the museum to think about Minty, or even to draw the birds. She was here to do a job for Finn, and when she was sure the museum was empty, she walked over to the private door and knocked. Professor Glastonbury came out at once. He really was a very nice man, with his round pink face and white fringe of hair. "I'm sorry to disturb you again," said Maya, "but I have a message for you." And she handed him the note that Finn had written in the hut. The professor read it and looked at her intently. So she had found Finn and made friends with him. Not only that, but she wanted to help him.
"Yes," he said. "I see. You are a messenger and to be trusted. Come in, come in."
He led her into his office and locked the door. Maya had never seen such a room. There wasn't a centimetre that wasn't covered in something. Limb casts, snake skins, jumbled bones and books everywhere, even on the floor. But it was a friendly clutter, not like the mess in Mr. Carter's room.
"Sit down," he said,
and moved a stuffed marmoset from a rickety chair. Then he read the note again.
"I don't see why not. If it's just for one night, no, I really don't see why not."
"He said you knew a good hiding place. He said you showed it to him." Professor Glastonbury smiled. He must have been close on 60, but he looked like a pleased pink baby.
"He remembered, did he? Well, come along. If Finn says you're to be trusted, I'm sure he's right."
He took her into the lab, and for the second time, Maya was led to the giant sloth. But this time, the professor put his shoulder to the heavy metal stand, which moved slowly to one side. On the wooden floor, grimed with dirt, Maya could just make out a square of darker coloured wood and an iron ring.
"It's a trap door," he said. "Goes down to a cellar and storeroom, but it's well ventilated. Got one high window. Best hiding place in Manaus, we used to say. Finn liked to play down there when he was little, while his father helped me."
Maya stood looking at the flight of steps which led into the darkness.
"Would you like to go down?"
the professor asked. "May I?"
"Of course, but you'd better have a light. There's no electricity down there."
He brought her a hurricane lamp and she climbed down. The cellar was huge and vaulted, with a recess at the back full of packing cases. Between the cases were exhibits which the professor had not had room for, or those waiting to be repaired. A beam of light fell on the red eyes of a moth-eaten puma. There were unstrung bows and painted shields and a harpy eagle sitting on a lopsided nest. In a corner was a heap of round objects which might have been carved coconuts but might have been shrunken heads. But the floor was dry, and in the far end of the room the high window gave a glimmer of light. "It's marvellous," said Maya, coming up again. "No one could find you unless they knew." The professor moved the stand back over the trapdoor.
"I sometimes store Billy down there when the trustees come on an inspection. They don't approve of stuffed Pekingese in a serious museum."
"There's just one more thing," said Maya, as the professor led her out of the lab. "Finn thought that we should, that I should, steal the spare keys so that no one gets into trouble. Your staff or you, if anything goes wrong."
"I doubt if anyone could do much to me,"
said Professor Glastonbury.
"But it's true. I wouldn't want my cleaners or my caretaker blamed."
"The trouble is," said Maya, looking up at him, "I haven't actually stolen anything before."
"There is always a first time," said the professor cheerfully. "The spare keys are hanging on that hook over there, and I'm going out in half an hour to have my lunch."
"There she is," said Mr. Trapwood, looking out of the window of the Pension Marie at the slender blue funnel of HMS Bishop, the sister ship of the Cardinal, which had just come into port. She would spend 4 days on the turnabout while the crew cleaned the ship, took on supplies, and had some time ashore. Then on Saturday morning she would set off again to the mouth of the Amazon, across the Atlantic, and back to Britain. The crows had been so sure of finding Taverner's son that they had booked a 3-berth cabin for the return journey. But they were beginning to give up hope, for it was clear that the wretched boy was deliberately hiding from them. At first, people had tried to deny that Taverner had a son at all. Now, though, they were beginning to laugh behind their sleeves, and as the day for the detective's departure grew closer, there were sly digs about the boy having outwitted them. But why? The crows were hurt. They had come as bearers of good tidings to bring a savage jungle boy the news of his inheritance. They had been prepared to introduce him gradually to polite society, perhaps on the journey to teach him to use a knife and fork. Sir Aubrey had even given them some money to buy him clothes, in case he'd been brought up in a grass skirt. And they had expected gratitude. It was only natural. "Thank you, Mr. Lowe," the boy would have said, grasping them by the hand, and "Thank you, Mr. Trapwood, you have saved me from my life of toil and darkness." Instead of that, the boy was deliberately hiding, and everyone in Manaus seemed to be helping him.
"We've got 3 more days, said Mr. Trapwood. "There's still a chance to flash him out, to carry him aboard by force if necessary, to get the bounties from Sir Aubrey."
That was the most important thing of all. Sir Aubrey had promised them £100 each if they brought his grandson safely home.
"I still think there was something fishy about that pigtailed girl at the Carter's place,"
Mr. Lowe agreed. "She had a shifty lack. We'll have to keep an eye on her." The crows were looking very much worse for wear. Their black suits were dusty and torn. The maid at the Pension Maria had burned every one of their shirts as she ironed them. Mr. Trapwood's face was covered in lumps where the bites of the Taverner fly had gone septic, and both their stomachs had become boiling caverns of agony and wind.
"But we can still do it," said Mr. Trapwood, punching the table. "We'll try down river this time. Those houses by the fishing place. The people there look poor enough. They should take some notice of the reward."
Mr. Lowe nodded and made his way stealthily towards the door.
"If you're thinking of getting to the lavatory before me, don't try," said Mr. Trapwood. "I'm going first."
"No, you aren't. I need it. You need it."
Shoving and jostling, the two detectives raced each other down the corridor. Professor Glastonbury, making his way up the hill to the cafe where he usually had his lunch, stopped, as he always did, by the bookshop in the square. It was run by a man who bought him books from all over Brazil, specialising in books about natural history. In the window was a copy of Travels in the Amazon by Alfred Russel Wallace, open at a beautiful woodcut of an Indian village. He was admiring it when he realised that the tall, straight-backed woman who was also staring into the window was the lady who had left Maya in the museum.
"A beautiful book,"
he said, raising his hat. She sighed.
"Yes, quite above my means, I fear." "It's not a first edition," he said. "You might get it quite reasonably. I know the owner. Perhaps he would put it aside for a while." "Thank you, but he would not have to put it aside for most of my life. My salary is not princely, even when it is paid."
Both of them looked for a while longer at the book. Then Miss Minton gave her tight-lipped smile.
"I was dismissed once for reading," she said.
"Really?"
The professor waited, but she said no more.
"I left Maya working hard," he went on. "The caretaker promised to keep an eye on her."
Did she know what Maya was really doing in the museum? He wondered. Probably not. Yet she didn't look like a person easy to hoodwink. As she bent down to pick up the basket with Mrs. Carter's shopping, he said,
"Allow me."
She shook her head.
"Thank you, but it's not heavy."
They began to walk towards the main street with its cafes and shops.
"I've been thinking about what you said, about the missing bone of Magathurum, the sloth I mean."
"You have decided to go and look for it."
"No, no, but Taverner was also against putting in a false rib. He was a good naturalist and a good man. I miss him."
"Yes, I can imagine that.
Was it he who found the skeleton?"
"No, it was found many years ago. It went to a museum in Rio, too important for my little place, but no one had time to assemble it, so they sent it down to me. But Taverner knew the place it came from. Not only that..."
He broke off.
"His wife came from up there," he went on. "It's practically unexplored country."
"Did you know his wife?"
"Yes. She was beautiful and gentle. She died in childbirth because the English doctor wouldn't come out to an Indian girl at night. As you can imagine, it didn't make Taverner any more anxious to return to England."
They walked on for a while without speaking. Then the professor, blushing a little for he was very shy, asked Miss Minton if she would care to join him for lunch.
"It's only a little local cafe, but the food is good."
But as he had expected, she refused.
"Thank you. I have some sandwiches."
But at the door of the cafe, Miss Minton was overcome suddenly by the glorious smell of real, strong Brazilian coffee.
"Perhaps a cup of coffee," she said.
It was a nice cafe,